Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations available 24/7 to the world online.
Today is November 18th, 2014. This is Dave Schwartz. I'm talking over the phone with Jack Harpster, who is a prolific author and author of the just-released book, The Curious Life of Nevada's Levere Redfield, the Silver King, Silver Dollar King. So, Jack, tell us a little bit about Levere Redfield. Who was he?
Well, Redfield was, he's often called Northern Nevada's Howard Hughes, a multimillionaire, very, very eccentric fellow, and a fellow who was really much misunderstood by the people who knew him and and were around him up here in Reno. Made his money during the Great Depression. He was a contrarian investor, and he made a lot of money in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, when the Depression came along and most people who had made money in the 20s lost it, he didn't. He just continued making money because he seemed to have a very delicate feel for the market. He made his first million in 1932. So from there, he was kind of launched. It's kind of difficult to track exactly how he made his money and everything, because people like this are usually, they play their cards pretty close to the vest. But he was involved in one very famous oil syndicate deal in Los Angeles in the 1920s and 30s that was a very high profile case of swindle, as it turns out. But Levere seemed to have come out of it.
Julian Petroleum, right?
That was it, yes, And he seemed to have come out of it pretty well. And by 1935, he was a multimillionaire. And California, mired in the Depression, were thinking of raising taxes on the wealthy. And about that time, the state of Nevada started a campaign called One Sound State to attract some of these multimillionaires to come into Nevada because of their low tax rates. Nevada was called a tax haven at the time. And Levere Redfield was one of about 50 or 60 multimillionaires who decided to move to Nevada. Most of these men were fairly well-known people. Mr. Cord of Cord Auburn and Duesenberg Automobiles, Mr. Luckenbach of the Luckenbach Steamship Lines, Bing Crosby the entertainer, pretty high-profile people, most of these multimillionaires, but Levere wasn't. Levere kind of flew under the radar, and when he moved into Reno, people really didn't notice him very much, which was just exactly the way he liked it. He was basically a shy man. He was not a person who tried to attract any attention to himself, and he did everything he could to stay unknown. Unfortunately, some of his deals, some of the things he did, and some of the things that were done to him over the years just were so high profile that he wasn't able to, to retain his anonymity forever. But he sure tried very, very hard. He came to Reno in 1935, and he was here until 1974 when he passed away. And the number of stories and legends and myth around the fellow, because he was a very secretive fellow, just grew and grew. And when I moved up here from Las Vegas about 9 years ago, I started hearing about him, and I heard all of these contradictions about him and everything. And I said, "Gee, he would be an interesting subject for a book." So I started doing some research on him and everything. I found a couple dozen people in town who had known the man and were willing to sit down with me and talk. And the The newspapers were a great source of information because, again, some of these high-profile things he was involved in obviously kept the newspapers full of stories for years and years. Then there were, you know, accounts of some of the things he had done in oral histories from some of the well-known people here, and got a lot of material from special collections at the University of Nevada, Reno. So, you know, even though he was a fairly secretive man, if you dug deep enough, you were able to find enough information to put out, you know, what I thought was an extremely interesting story.
So what are some of the misconceptions that people had about him at the time? What were some of the things they said about him, about his frugality?
Well, that was one of the things that everyone, you know, everyone knew about him. He was really cheap. He was ultra frugal. There were no contradictions there because he really was. There are all sorts of stories. He would go down to the corner grocery store, for instance, and buy all of the canned goods that the labels had inadvertently been torn off of in shipment or something. And he would pay a dime a piece for these canned goods. Then he and his wife would eat these things for dinner, and he joked once. He said it was a lot of fun. You opened a can for dinner, you never knew if it was peas or pears. And his grandniece, who was a student at Stanford back in the 50s, and when she would come out to visit him, she said it was always great fun to have dinner at Levere's house, because he'd tell you to go out and pick two or three cans, you know, cans with no labels, and that was what we were going to have for dinner. And she said it was always great fun for him to see what everyone came up with. So, that's the type of story that we hear so often about Redfield, and that the part about his frugality was indeed, a true story. There were rumors that he was antisocial, and that was not true at all. Nor was he, like Howard Hughes, reclusive. He spent an awful lot of time out in the community, but because, again, he did not want to be recognized, he liked his anonymity. He normally wore an old checkered shirt, overalls or blue jeans, and workman's boots. So most people who did see him out in the community did not know this, you know, this is the millionaire Redfield. In fact, close neighbors of his would often see this old fellow puttering around in his lawn of his big stone castle with these old clothes on, and they thought he was the gardener, but it was in truth Levere Redfield himself. So he did try to retain his anonymity that way, and for the first first dozen years he was in Reno, he did manage to, you know, kind of fly below the radar. You never heard much about him. He just went about his business. And then in 1948, in a story I tell in the prologue of the book, he suffered a terrible mugging. He had been downtown Reno gambling at one of the casinos. He was a prodigious gambler, and that's something we can get back to in a minute. But and on his way walking home from downtown, a mugger attacked him and beat him over the head, according to Levere's later estimate, 12 to 15 times with a brick, trying to get him to turn over $2,300 winnings that he had made in downtown Reno. And Levere, always tight with a buck, would not give the money up, and it almost killed him. He spent weeks and weeks and weeks in the hospital after that particular mugging, and this was in the paper and everything, and this was the first that most people knew that there was this strange, eccentric, rich fellow living right in their midst. After that, the type of things that he was involved in just kind of steamrolled, and he was in the paper more and more often all the time, and unfortunately, you know, he lost his anonymity. But he continued. He just continued to be involved in all of these strange happenings. As far as being eccentric, he did not believe in banks. He did a certain amount of business with banks, but he did not trust banks to keep his savings. And a lot of people who survived the Great Depression felt that way. So many banks had closed, and even here in Reno, George Wingfield's 13 banks, very famously, all closed down in bankruptcy during the Great Depression. So Redfield, like a lot of people, you know, during the Depression, were wary of banks, and he would never, you know, he would never keep his money in a bank. Well, he did accumulate a lot of wealth. He accumulated gold and silver, hard assets like that, and he kept them all in his house. And eventually, I guess, word got around about that. And the first robbery that he and his wife had to endure was in 1952, when his home was broken into by a crew of burglars that were really more bunglers than burglars. They were a real strange bunch of misfits, but they did get away with about $1.5 million worth of his assets in this 1952 burglary. And that burglary at the time was the largest burglary in U.S. history. It even surpassed the great Brinks robbery in Boston, which had happened the year before, by about $250,000. So, again, very, very high-profile burglary. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI got involved in it. Hoover even made a public statement about this particular robbery. I collected a lot of news clips about the robbery, and to give you an idea of how, you know, of how internationally famous this robbery became, I have a clip about it from the newspaper in Canberra, Australia. So it did truly, the word of this robbery, because it was so big at the time, reached across the globe. And once again, Redfield's anonymity was kind of shot down with all of that.
So tell me a little bit about his gambling. When did he start gambling big?
You know, as far as can be told, Redfield started gambling as soon as he moved to Reno in 1935. Now, I was able to uncover no anecdotal evidence of that because, you know, all of the old-timers who might have had stories to tell or anything did not go back that far. He was a contrarian investor, and that's probably about the biggest gamble of all. Mm-hmm. So he did, you know, he had gambler's blood in his veins. There's no question about that. Gambling was legalized in 1931, so by the time he came in 35, gambling was legal. The first true evidence we have of his gambling came in 1948 during that mugging. He had won $2,300 gambling at roulette downtown. $2,300 in 1948 was a lot of money. We know that wasn't the first time he gambled, so I think it's a safe assumption that he had begun gambling soon after he came to Reno and just kept it up all the way up until 1974 when he passed away. He was a prodigious gambler here, and in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, he would win or lose $100,000 at a time downtown playing roulette. Never seemed to faze him at all, whether he won it or lost it. This was just his hobby, and he seemed to be addicted to the thrill of gambling. I call him, in my book, I call him Nevada's first whale, and I think there's plenty of evidence that he's the first person that would, that would match that definition that the casinos consider their very, very biggest customers are whales. And I think Redfield was probably Nevada's first whale, because certainly there were none of those in Las Vegas, you know, up until, well, the 1950s, when Las Vegas finally started growing. So, everyone knew the man in town by this time, by the 50s and 60s. Didn't know him personally, but knew him by reputation. And many people would follow his gambling, you know, watch him if they happened to be in a casino when he was playing. They would watch him. He played nothing but roulette. And he played it very, very well. Bill Hara, who started his gambling empire here in Reno, and at one time Harris Gaming was the largest gambling organization in the world, I believe, was it not?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Bill Harrah himself said of Redfield something to the effect, he was the best I ever saw. He said he, you know, he had a tremendous mind for roulette. He had a, you knew, he knew his math very, very well, and Harrah just said he's the best player I've ever seen. And he said, all in all, I think he probably came out ahead of us over the years. So, you know, that's pretty high praise from one of the giants in the industry, that Redfield really knew what he was doing. The book has a number of stories in it, both about some of his winning outings at the casinos and also about some of the losing outings. I mean, he just, you know, and there were some of each, of course. He even admitted once to Robert Laxalt, who was one of Northern Nevada's most famous writers, that he knew gambling was foolish. He said, gambling is a foolish thing to do, and I'm one of the fools who do it. So he knew, you know, what a risk he was taking, but he said, I can afford one expensive avocation, and this is what I choose to do. So he realized he was going to win some and lose some, and this was the only exception to this, you know, this tremendous tight-fistedness that he was known for was his gambling.
That's interesting, because it seems like that's a bit of a contradiction. If on one hand he's, you know, allegedly, I know you discount this in the book, but people are saying that he's lighting his mansion by candles to save money. You know, on the other hand, he's blowing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars at roulette. How did you come up with any insights into how he could do that?
You know, the no real deep insights as far as that was concerned. I mean, in every other aspect of his life, he was about as cheap with a dollar as anyone could possibly be. You know, the only thing we have is his own words here, where he said, you know, I know it's foolishness, but I'm wealthy enough to where I can afford, you know, one expensive habit, one expensive hobby, and this is it. Again, you know, he had this gambler's blood in his veins, and he just seemed that to be the exception to every other rule, where you never spend a dime if you don't have to.
Yeah. So his frugality led to some legal troubles for him. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. It wasn't his, well, I guess you could call it his frugalities. He did not believe that the government, the IRS, had the right, the constitutional right, to tax its citizens. I think part of that came from the fact that he was born in 1897, and he had five brothers, older brothers, who were quite successful in the Ogden, Utah community where he was born. And up until 1917, neither he nor any of his brothers, you know, were subject to income taxes, because the government didn't start that until 1916. So I think there was kind of a, you know, a basic feeling here that the government didn't have a right to tax you, just because it had never been done up until, you know, they were already earning a lot of money. So he didn't, you know, he didn't seem to feel it was a crime to hide as many of his assets and avoid as much IRS taxation as he could, and that's what he did. And unfortunately, it eventually caught up with him in the early 60s, and he was tried for income tax evasion, basically for hiding assets. He was found guilty, and he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. But by the time all of the appeals were over and everything else toward the late 60s, when he went to prison, he had a couple of heart attacks, so they let him out early. He ended up only serving two of the 6 years. But, you know, he did always carry that felon label with him after that, but didn't bother him at all. He wasn't the type of person who really cared a whit what anyone else thought of him. You know, I mean, he was his own man, did not matter what people thought of him. But, you know, he always tried to hide his assets, and he got caught that one time. hid his hard assets in the basement of his house, as I said earlier. That's what the burglars eventually found out. And there were two times, once during his lifetime in that 1952 burglary, and once after his death when they were trying to, when the attorneys were trying to find all of the assets in his estates, that they discovered false walls in his basement, behind which he had hidden hundreds of thousands of silver dollars that he had either collected or hoarded. It depends upon which story you believe. But silver dollars, you know, were used the same as gaming chips in the 30s and 40s and even into the 1950s. If you were in Reno or Las Vegas, you could go to a bank and buy a bag of a thousand silver dollars, and you could exchange dollars for paper money for silver dollars in a casino. And he just started gathering and saving these silver dollars, and among the ones that he had, after he passed away, I think it was 407,000 silver dollars they found hidden behind a false wall in his basement. And many of these were extremely rare and valuable coins. In the late 70s, they auctioned off, as part of probating his estate, they auctioned off his collection of silver dollars, and it sold for $7.3 million, which at the time was the largest, highest priced coin deal ever made in the country. So, again, these were just some of the very unusual things that he was involved with.
So what was his legacy?
You know, that's a hard thing to say. He wasn't a real charitable fellow. The book does have a number of incidents of charitable things he did for people, but it was usually on the sly, one-on-one. He wasn't a big charitable giver. He didn't leave anything to charity in his will. But he liked to help people in need without anyone else knowing it. I think the reason he tried to do it secretly was he felt if everyone knew how wealthy he was and knew that he was, you know, giving money away to the needy people, they'd all be coming out of the woodwork. But, given his wealth, he really didn't give a lot away to charity, nothing in his will. However, in Nevada is a community property state, and after his death, half of his estate went to his wife. And his wife set up something called the Nell J. Redfield Trust, and she died 7 years later, and her entire wealth, her half of the estate, went into the Nell J. Redfield Trust, which has spent about, by this time, probably about $70 or $75 million in Las Vegas, building buildings at the university and all around town. Just a tremendous legacy in the name of his wife through this Nell J. Redfield Foundation or trust. But Redfield himself really didn't leave much of a legacy. He was also the biggest landowner in Reno. He started buying land as soon as he moved to Nevada and ended up owning about 50,000 acres of land both in the city and in the Sierras surrounding Nevada. And he refused to sell any of it and refused to allow it to be built on during his lifetime. So a lot of the land in the Sierras around here is still undeveloped land, and that's thanks to the fact that Levere owned it and refused to sell it or refused to allow anybody to subdivide it. So the fact that there is still so much pristine forest land here, that might be his biggest legacy.
Interesting. So what do you think the biggest thing that you learned from this whole project was?
Well, I learned that there are an awful lot of people, interesting people, who fly beneath the radar, and that if you're willing to dig deep enough, you can find a story behind a lot of these people. I don't travel much. My first three books were about people back east or in the Midwest, and to do those kind of things, you have to travel a lot, spend a lot of money in order to do research. I don't do that anymore. I find that there are enough interesting people like Redfield, you know, around up here in northern Nevada that it can keep a biographer like myself happy for years and years to come. You've just got to keep your ears open to these kind of things, and a lot of people have tremendous stories to tell.
Fascinating. So any thoughts on your next project?
Well, I'm working right now on a book. If you don't know Reno well, you might not be familiar with the Riverside Hotel here or the Virginia Street Bridge. Both still exist in town today, and there was a bridge and on the same site and a hotel on the same site in 1859 when what would one day become Reno were first settled. And I am telling the story of this Riverside Hotel and Virginia Street Bridge, each of which are in their fourth or fifth iteration by this time. But there's so much history to these two structures that I'm writing an institutional biography of those things right now. The bridge itself, the current bridge, the one that goes right over Virginia Street now, was built in 1907. 1905, I'm sorry. So it's way, way overdue to be rebuilt, and there are plans afoot now and plans underway to rebuild the Virginia Street Bridge. And that book is basically finished, except I have to wait until the new bridge is built. I feel it would not be a right thing to do to put that book out until it's complete, and it won't be complete till the new Virginia Street Bridge is built, which could be another 2 years. So, and I have nothing else in the works right now. That's not necessarily true. There is another book written, which is a biography of a gentleman well known in the Reno and the Lake Tahoe area named Duane L. Bliss, and a book called The Lumber Baron of the Comstock Lode, The Life and Times of Duane L. Bliss, will be published in April of 2015. And that'll be my eighth book. He was one of the most important people on the Comstock Lode back in the 1860s through the 1890s. He provided all the lumber that supported all these deep underground mines that contained so much silver and gold. And then when those mines petered out in the 1890s, he started building tourism into the Lake Tahoe area. Mm-hmm. And he was the first person to bring national and even international tourism to Lake Tahoe. So he's pretty well known up in these neck of the woods, and that book was finished a couple of years ago, and it'll come out in April of next year.
Interesting. So this book is The Curious Life of Nevada's Lavere Redfield. Jack Harpster, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much, Dave.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Center, UNLV, its faculty, staff, or benefactors. For more information, please see us on the web at gaming.unlv.edu.